From NPR News, this is special coverage of the president's speech on Syria. I'm Scott Simon. President Obama will address the nation and the world about Syria in about 15 minutes. According to reports, the president will share some of the factors that he's weighing as he decides how the U.S. may respond now that his administration has concluded that the Assad regime has used chemical weapons in Syria that killed more than 1,400 people. The president has reportedly been speaking with congressional leaders today. The UN chemical weapons team has left Damascus and is en route to Europe. They will eventually provide a report to the Secretary General of the United Nations. There was a press conference at the United Nations earlier today in which they underscored that UN personnel specifically engaged in humanitarian work will remain on the job in Damascus. We will carry the president's remarks live. We will turn to our correspondents in Washington, D.C. and around the world as U.S. military forces are in place. It's Saturday, August 31, 2013. From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Barack Obama's speech on Syria. I'm Scott Simon. And President Obama will address the nation in a few minutes. The administration may be preparing for a military strike on Syria, although President Obama says he has not made a final decision about military action. A UN inspections team left Syria this morning. It is now in the Netherlands, where it will analyze samples that were collected at the site of a poison gas attack just outside of Damascus. But the Obama administration is not waiting for the results of UN inspections. It says it is already convinced that Bashar al-Assad's regime used chemical weapons during that attack. And yesterday, the White House released a summary of intelligence that says more than 1,400 civilians were killed by chemical weapons. We're joined first now by NPR's White House correspondent, Scott Horsley, who's in the studio. Scott, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
What can we fairly expect to hear from the president?
Well, the signal that we're getting from the White House is that this is not going to be an announcement of imminent military action. That is, the president's not going to come out and tell us that we've begun launching missiles into Syria. For one thing, he's going to be speaking from the sunny Rose Garden, which would not be a setting for that sort of announcement. Instead, what we expect is sort of an update on his thinking and his decision-making process as concerns Syria. Now, the White House is also in the process of meeting with members of the Senate today and members of the House tomorrow by telephone with the Senate, an in-person meeting with some House members tomorrow. So the administration says we're keeping Congress in the loop. The president's also been having consultations with allies overseas. He spoke yesterday with David Cameron of Britain and the President Hollande of France. So I think they want to give the impression that the final decision has not yet been made.
What are the points, near as you can tell, that the president has been making, or that Secretary Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel reportedly have been making in some of their consultations? How is the administration essentially honing and polishing the argument that they want to present?
Well, part of what they're doing is just sort of adding the footnotes to what Secretary Kerry said yesterday about the evidence that has led the administration to conclude it was, in fact, the Syrian regime behind that deadly chemical weapons attack last week. When they put out a declassified summary of the evidence, and Secretary Kerry went through that in a speech at the State Department yesterday. But they've said a lot of this is stuff we're not going to be able to reveal to the broad public because they don't want to compromise future intelligence gathering. They are prepared to give members of Congress sort of the detail. So what we have from the Secretary and in this sort of public report is a summary of what they say they know. What they're providing members of Congress is also the substantiation of that. But I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of doubt in Congress that the Syrian regime is behind the chemical weapons attack.
Well, that was my next question, is if they're running into much skepticism. If maybe not skepticism over whether the regime in Syria is behind it, whether or not the proof actually exists.
And they're meeting skepticism on both sides. There are members of Congress who don't want the U.S. to take any military action. They say, look, it's unlikely to have a big effect, and it could open up a real hornet's nest for the United States. There are other members of Congress who say, look, let's not go in with some half measure. We need to do something that's going to tip the balance of power in the civil war in Syria and help to move Assad out of his leadership position. The president has said that any military strike would specifically not be aimed at a regime change in Syria.
To what degree is the president personally involved in these consultations, using the matchless prestige of that office to make this appeal?
He has been reaching out personally. In addition to the conference call that's being held with the senators this afternoon, with Secretary Kerry and Secretary Hagel, the defense secretary, and the national security advisor, Susan Rice, and the head of national intelligence, the president has also been making personal calls to members of Congress.
We want to go now to NPR's Peter Kenyon, who's on duty for us in Beirut. Peter, can you hear us?
Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Joined by Scott Horsley here. From your perspective, in the actual affected region itself, what do you think a lot of people in the Middle East might want to hear from President Obama?
Well, that's a tough one, Scott. I mean, you've got a number of Arab states, especially in the Persian Gulf, such as Saudi Arabia, who very much want to see someone do something to, for want of a better word, slap down Bashar al-Assad or show him that there are limits to what he can do. But they don't want to say that publicly because they're worried about a backlash should this turn into a wider regional struggle. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got people criticizing from the other side of the coin. Now, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, says he looked at what John Kerry said, and he says, if they're trying to do a 1 or 2 day hit and run prior to the G20 summit in the coming week, that's not good enough. They should be pushing the regime to the point of collapse. And then you've got popular protests all across the region against any kind of military action on general pacifist principles. So, yeah, it's a very mixed message, I'd say.
Yeah. And as you take a look and review the various countries around the region, what kind of concerns do you hear about possible consequences of even a limited U.S. military strike?
Well, there's a ton of consequences that are possible. The refugee crisis that is already huge could get much, much worse. There are the possibilities of retaliation further afield, either into Israel, where the gas mask supplies have been going up, or to Gulf oil installations. They could become targets, Western military bases in the region. Getting back to Turkey briefly, that border area, very long land border, has already seen spillover violence and could be the scene of quite a bit more. Here in Lebanon, there is the added X factor of the Hezbollah Shiite militia, which is pro-Syrian and has already intervened in the area of Qusair to try and help the Assad regime militarily. If they get involved, that again could bring in Israel again. It could also have them back in Syria. The complications are almost endless.
We want to ask Scott Horsley and Peter Kenyon to stand by. I'm told we're joined now by Tom Bowman, who covers defense matters for NPR. Tom, can you hear us?
I can, Scott.
Give us some idea, if you can, about what kind of military assets, to the best of your knowledge, the United States has in position right now.
Well, there are 5 Navy ships in the Eastern Mediterranean, and they have Tomahawk cruise missiles that could be used against select Syrian military sites. If the president gives the order, they're looking at several dozen Syrian sites, including command and control centers, headquarters, rocket and missile launch sites, some of which were used, according to Secretary of State John Kerry, to fire chemical weapons against some of those sites in the Damascus suburb. So the Pentagon says they're pretty much ready to go. They're just waiting for an order from President Obama.
Mm-hmm. And any idea how long such an operation might last or how extensive it might be?
What we're hearing is it'd be 2 days of strikes, again, against several dozen sites and the Syrian military. And of course, the president has said these would be limited strikes. They're not looking at regime change. They're not looking at a widespread bombing campaign like we'd see at the beginning of the Iraq War, for example. And of course, the president has said repeatedly, and others have said, they don't foresee any American troops on the ground. No boots on the ground is the way they put it. So again, everyone has said from the beginning that this would be a limited military action against the Syrian regime.
And I want to turn to you and Scott Horsley with this question. I've heard it said a lot this week that this is a president who, in a sense, came to prominence by articulating anti-war views, or as he said, I'm not opposed to all wars, just stupid wars, meaning the war in Iraq, and is often portrayed as a reluctant warrior. On the other hand, he has ordered an awful lot of drone strikes. This is someone who has become very familiar with the language of war and weighing considerations over the past few years.
Well, and that's a contradiction that President Obama himself addressed in his Nobel Peace Prize speech, where he said, look, there are times when you have to use force. And he has said repeatedly, in the case of chemical weapons, that this is an international norm that has been violated, and the international community can't turn a blind eye to that. In his Nobel Peace Prize speech, he says the word of the international community has to mean something. And he's warned that both in practical terms and sort of moral terms, the international community needs to back up what is now a near-century-old ban on the use of chemical weapons.
When he was running for office, President Obama also talked about the need for congressional approval. Does he feel this consultation process, Congress being mostly out of town at the moment, does he feel this consultation progress, this consultation process essentially meets that requirement?
Well, I think the White House has been careful not to even ask that question, not to even give the opportunity for Congress to register its disapproval the way Parliament did in Britain. I think this is a case where better to ask forgiveness than permission. Mm.
Peter Kenyon, let me turn to you and help us understand Middle Eastern leaders who believe that there's no sense in making a strike unless it actually is aimed at regime change.
Well, there is a longstanding differences here, and the alliance between Iran and Syria in particular has been a thorn in the side of many of the regional states, mostly Sunni Arab states in that case. And the possibility of just creating pain on the ground that angers the regime and perhaps forces it to try and respond, and especially if its allies respond, either Hezbollah or Iran, that just creates more trouble, could be economically disastrous. And then you come to the other side of that question, which is, well, if you push for regime change, will that in fact make things equally bad just by a different route? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure there's a great answer here, and I don't think any of the leaders here could spell out an easy solution to this problem. A lot of minds have been wrestling with it for quite some time. They're well into the third year now of this uprising, and I'm not sure there is a good solution that involves violence. Mm-hmm.
Tom Bowman, I think a lot of people in the defense establishment have been openly torn, too. On the one hand, moved by the crisis they see in Syria. On the other hand, not exactly certain that there's a military route, at least, that they have in their hands that they could undertake to do much about it. Give us an insight into the kind of thinking you've been hearing at the Defense Department.
Well, you know, you start with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey. He's been wary about getting involved militarily. He said there are certain, you know, tensions within Syrian society that are not going to be solved just by launching a few cruise missiles. There's no military solution here. And if the U.S. weighs in, then what do you do? Do you form some sort of a new government if you try to take out Assad? So there's a great reluctance to do anything military. They just don't see that as providing an answer here. And also it's informed by the more recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, how long it took and how, you know, both countries are still troubled more than a decade after the U.S. military went in. So there's a real reluctance to start down the road militarily, but it appears like that's what's going to happen.
This is special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria. I'm Scott Simon. We are expecting the president to appear in the Rose Garden of the White House really any minute now. We're joined by Scott Horsley, who covers the White House for NPR, Tom Bowman, who covers defense matters, and Peter Kenyon, who's on duty for us in Beirut. Scott, the NBC News poll found nearly 80% of Americans believe the president should get congressional approval. 80% has to impress any politician, even one who's already been reelected to office.
Absolutely. And both the president and Secretary of State Kerry said yesterday they understand the wariness and the weariness of the American public after more than a decade of war. The president said no one is more war-weary than he is. But they also warned that while there are challenges with doing something in this situation, there are perhaps greater risks with doing nothing. Now, it's also very much the president's preference that if something is to be done, that it not be done by the United States acting alone, but it'd be done by a coalition of countries. And he's been, I think, frustrated that it's been hard to muster such a coalition. We heard Peter Kenyon talking about some of the allies in the Middle East who very much want the United States to act, but don't want to come out and say so publicly. And the president made reference to this yesterday when he was speaking at the White House. He said a lot of people think something should be done, but nobody wants to do it. But he also said that, you know, part of the mantle of being a superpower and the responsibility of that position is sometimes the United States does have to act on his own. And he's made it pretty clear that this may be a case where he'll do that.
Mm-hmm. I believe France has continued to express its support, but it's not clear to me that there are any French. Tom Bowman, you back me up on this. Any French military assets are planned to be part of an operation at the beginning?
No, the French have warships in the Mediterranean, just like the U.S., but there's no sense at all at this point that the French would get involved in any sort of missile strikes. I believe the French are planning for a vote next week. I don't think they would be involved in this particular military action.
There's also a meeting of the Arab League that has been moved up till tomorrow, that would be some nice cover if they could get some seal of approval from either the Arab League or at least some Arab states.
Peter Kenyon, let me turn to you in Beirut and get back to something that Scott Horsley touched on. The president's concern that although there are a welter of consequences to weigh and to consider in this point, there are also consequences for doing nothing after chemical weapons have been used. How do people in the region see the prospect of doing nothing?
Well, I think that is a serious issue, and it's an issue regionally. It's also an issue in many other parts of the world, South Korea, North Korea, for example, just anywhere where these weapons might be used. But it's something that the region does not want to see nothing happen. They would love to see diplomacy get back on track, but frankly, that's been a complete failure, I think you'd have to say, up to this point, not pointing fingers at any one side, but the intransigence is on both sides. The rebel groups and the government has essentially precluded any serious diplomatic effort. This talk of Geneva II, another round of meetings that keeps getting pushed back month after month after month, and now seems farther away than ever. I think diplomacy is something that people long for, and they just don't know how to get there from here.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria. The president is expected to address the nation and the world, really, about Syria in a few moments from the Rose Garden at the White House. NPR's veteran correspondent, Deborah Amos, who has covered so much of the Middle East for the past few years, is able to join us now. Deborah, can you hear us?
I can.
Help us understand what this event, what the administration is convinced has been the use of chemical weapons in Syria. How that the president a few weeks ago, obviously a couple of months ago, spoke about a red line. We've been getting emails this morning from people who genuinely want to understand what does the deployment of chemical weapons mean in the Middle East in this conflict? Why has that considered to be some kind of watershed?
I think that historically the international community has abhorred chemical weapons enough to make an international convention against them. And so there
of which Syria is a signatory, I believe. As well as the United States.
Syria is not, but
really?
They are, yes, they are a signatory to the Geneva Conventions,
right,
which does cover these events. Syria has one of the largest stockpiles in the world, and it has been, in this rebellion, increasingly part of their toolbox. There have been small events of chemical weapons. An analyst explained to me that this is the poor man's neutron bomb, that if you are battling insurgents that are in neighborhoods around your capital, that it is hard to bomb them. It is easier to use a small amount of chemical weapons, which up till now had been what the regime had been doing. This is an event that is much larger than anything else that we have seen to date. Now, I have to point out that yesterday there was a napalm-like attack on a school outside of Aleppo. The pictures are horrific of people who have peeling skin, But that does not come under the Weapons of Mass Destruction Convention. And it was a plane attack. It was obviously the regime. There's no doubt about who carried it out. It was hardly covered yesterday in most news outlets. Mm.
And what is the answer, Deborah, and maybe Tom Bowman can weigh in on this too, when the Syrian regime says it must have been one of the rebel groups that used those kinds of weapons?
Well, I think, go ahead, Tom.
Well, the sense is that the rebels don't have the capability to use chemical weapons. If you look at the scale of this attack, more than 1,400 killed. The U.S. intelligence says missiles were fired. They know where, by telemetry, they know where the missile was launched from a Syrian-controlled area to a rebel-controlled area. They'd be able to pick it up by satellite. So they say their information is pretty solid, but again, they don't think the rebels have the capacity to actually mount this kind of an attack, although the Syrian government is pointing to the rebels in this instance.
Mm. And Deborah, is there concern that the United States and other nations have that those kinds of weapons could eventually fall into hands that could more easily deploy them against American interests?
Certainly, that is a concern here. But I'd like to address your previous question. There has been some doubt sown with a Russian report that was delivered to the United Nations that said that they had assessed the sarin on the ground and it didn't have stabilizers in it. And that pointed to the possibility that rebels had used sarin gas in an attack on a small scale in Syria. There was also a report in a Turkish paper about a group of rebels who had sarin gas in a hotel room and were arrested. So there has been seeds of doubt over the claim that this could only be carried out by the regime. And I think that's why the administration has been so clear in actually going further than I think I've ever seen them do in sharing intelligence in the normal language that says we are almost certain. But still, it was a very strong case that they presented yesterday.
And also the administration admits that there are gaps in the intelligence as well. They do not have physiological evidence from the attack scene, blood, soil samples, tissue samples that the experts say would show whether or not sarin was used. There are certain compounds that would remain weeks after an attack that they could pick up and determine, you know, if sarin was used. Apparently the UN is still working on its samples from the site, but the U.S. At this point said that's one of the gaps in their intelligence.
Is that proof would be difficult to come by at this point, I gather.
Well,
I think it's also just a matter of time. You know, the UN has taken samples, but it'll take a couple of weeks, they've said, to evaluate those.
That's exactly right.
One thing Secretary Kerry said yesterday is that they all are well aware that the atmosphere has been affected by what happened in the run-up to the Iraq War, and that skepticism that was sown because of that. And John Kerry said, we will not make that mistake again. We've checked this information. We've rechecked this information. And they've issued these findings with what they say is high confidence, which is the one step below certainty as far as the intelligence community is concerned.
And if I could pick up on something that Deb said, that this was a much larger attack than what we've seen in the past, allegedly from the Syrian regime using chemical weapons. The sense I'm getting from Pentagon sources is that someone overplayed his hand here and maybe used too much of the chemical munition than necessary, and that's why you had such a large number of casualties.
You mean some Syrian commander overplayed
exactly.
His hand?
Exactly. Yeah. And the sense is, from Pentagon sources, is that what Assad wants to do is clear the Damascus suburbs of rebels and then move on to Aleppo, you know, the real center of rebel strength.
And NPR's Ron Elving joins us, Washington editor. Ron, thank you very much for joining us in the studio. This is a position that I think a lot of people would have said this Nobel Peace Prize-winning president would not be in politically, practically, otherwise. What considerations does he have to weigh now?
The considerations he has to weigh begin really with the consequences of any next move that he makes. He has, as he has said in the last 72 hours several times, a keen sense of what happens if we do nothing. He is afraid that there is a green light effect, that people all over the world who would like to test our limits will then see this as their opportunity.
Iran, North Korea.
You can fill in the blank. You can also talk about groups that don't necessarily even have a name, or people that we loosely gather under the title of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda here, Al-Qaeda there. Anybody who pops up with some sort of terrorist organization and has any kind of reference at all to a jihadist kind of agenda gets called Al-Qaeda. They could be anywhere. That could happen at any time. And chemical weapons can be dispersed, not easily, but they can be taken places and they can be used much more easily than some other kinds of terror weapons or other kinds of terror devices. And this is something that the president wants to highlight. It's something that he once used the phrase red line, as we've been saying so often, to underline that chemical weapons are in a special category. That's why he is so loath to let this incident go unpunished, as he says, or unrecognized, or in some sense or another, unresponded to.
And has he had a harder time selling this line to some members of his own party than, let's say, I would have guessed a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, because many Democrats, and something like 20 or more Democrats, have signed on to this letter demanding that he bring this to a vote in the Congress. That's primarily Republicans who have signed that letter, but some 20 Democrats have. And many Democrats have always felt philosophically that no president should be committing U.S. resources, U.S. assets, and U.S. lives, and committing military acts, offensive acts around the world, without some kind of approval from Congress. Maybe not a declaration of war, haven't had one of those since 1941, but some kind of congressional approval of the kind that we've had for some of these large actions in the past.
And on the other side, there are also people in Congress that think that this might not be the kind of action, I think the president referred to it as a shot across the bow, that something stronger is needed.
That's right, and that we need to make the big commitment. This is always a tremendous tension that was once expressed during the Bush years as by ourselves if we must, but with others if we can. We'd love to do this with others, but we will go ahead and do it on our own if we must. Sometimes people suspected the Bush administration of actually preferring to operate on our own because that gave us a great deal more freedom and we didn't have to wait for a coalition to get together. Mm-hmm. Right now, of course, it appears the United States is in some sense waiting for at least some kind of international support. The Brits pulled out earlier this week. The president was obviously expecting David Cameron to be his wingman in this, and that has not eventuated. So under those circumstances, we are more or less forced to make the solo or no-go decision that the president is clearly uncomfortable with.
This is NPR's special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria. The president is expected, has been expected for some minutes to appear in the Rose Garden and address the American people and the world on the situation in Syria and the options he's weighing at this moment. Let's go back to NPR's Deb Abrams, of course, who has covered the region for 3 decades. Deb, where does the Syrian civil war stand right now?
I think that it stands on hold as everybody is waiting for what is happening. It seems incredible to me that this doesn't have some tipping if the president does decide to bomb. What we know from the ground is that Syrian troops are on the move. Many of them are leaving their bases without proper preparation, no food, no water. They're on the road. They're moving into neighborhoods, into apartments. They are getting out of their bases. We also know from reports from the field that there are weapons crossing the border, both on the Turkish side and the Jordanian side, that the rebels have moved forward, seeing this as an opportunity as the regime tries to prepare itself for what they believe are the strikes to come. So I think it will take a while for us to see what the effects are if the president decides to go. Before the chemical weapons were used on the 21st, allegedly, the regime was in the ascendancy. They mm-hmm. had, with the help of Iran and the Hezbollah militia from Lebanon, actually done better. The momentum was on their side. There are many that argued, why would they use chemical weapons now? And the momentum may move a bit because of this tension. And then we have to see what happens happens if there are strikes.
Tom Bowman, does the U.S. military believe that a couple of days of airstrikes can do much to decimate the forces of the Syrian regime to the point where it could tip the balance?
Absolutely not. These are limited strikes. You would need to do much more robust strikes to really tip the balance. But picking up on what Deb said, there's growing support now in Congress and among military officials I talk with about giving more support to the Syrian rebels. It doesn't necessarily have to be arms, but more coordination, more training, particularly in Jordan, and then pushing them up into the southern part of Syria, which is now rebel-held. So watch if there are strikes, even if there aren't strikes, actually, you could see a lot more talk about providing more support to the rebels. Right now, there's non-lethal support coming from the United States, food, water, radios, and so forth. There is some talk of some sort of lethal assistance coming in from the CIA. But watch for the military, for the Pentagon, perhaps, to start providing more training and assistance in what we're seeing now.
Ron Elving, is there a rebel group or two or three rebel groups that the administration feels it can do business with, that it would maybe like to promote?
There is a hierarchy, but it is not necessarily a hierarchy of desirable options. Mm-hmm. It's more a hierarchy of the opposite. Which one of these would we least like to see in power? Which ones of these could we find most acceptable? Some people believe that the strongest units within the resistance, within this muddle of resistance groups, are actually the ones who are most closely affiliated with al-Qaeda or could even be called al-Qaeda. That would obviously not be in the United States' interest if they were to be the ones who emerged in a post-Assad world. So that's another conundrum for the president. If we do put our thumb on the scale in this way, and if we do become more active in supporting the opposition, how do we go about that so as to discourage that particular undesirable outcome?
And General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has been pretty outspoken about that concern.
Deb Amos, you've covered this conflict really since the beginning, off and on. Are there rebel groups that this administration or almost any U.S. administration would be comfortable with?
There are some,
are they in a position to win out?
Well, there are some, and General Salim Idris is the one most favored by the United States. There have been talks; he has spoken with ambassadors, and he is the nominal head of the Free Syrian Army, which is more like a brand than an army. And he is not strong enough to prevail against the regime. His forces are stronger in the south than they are in the north, where you'll see more of the al-Qaeda-like brigades around Aleppo, around Raqqa, in the east of Syria. In the north, in the south, there are less elements, jihadist elements, and it's because the town of Dera, most of the rebels there are hometown boys. It was not a place that was particularly radical before the uprising. That's where the Americans appear to be focusing most of their attention. There is a command center in Amman, Jordan. The Americans are involved in vetting which rebels get the weapons. They share that duty with the Turks and the French. It's Saudi arms that are coming through Amman into southern Syria. Remember, the Eastern Ghouta does benefit from that arms traffic that is coming up through Jordan. That is about an hour's drive from the northern Jordanian border.
This is NPR special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria. President Obama is expected to come into the White House Rose Garden and address the nation and the world about Syria as he weighs the consequences and the options for U.S. military action. Peter Kenyon in Beirut. Let me ask you about Israel's position in this, because one of the consequences that is often cited is the chance that that Syria specifically or Iranian units operating in Syria or on their own would make some kind of strike toward Israel. What are the chances of that? What are Israeli reactions to that?
Well, I think if this narrow act, as President Obama calls it, takes place as advertised, the hope would be that it would not provoke the kind of retaliation that would involve Israel. Now, Israel's position is quite complicated in this whole thing. You probably remember when this uprising started, Israel was no big fan of the uprising against Bashar al-Assad because they felt that this was the devil they know. Mm-hmm. The Golan Heights had been quiet for years and years, and they were not excited about the idea of revolution and the chaos that might entail. Now the situation, you know, into the third year later, has become much more complicated. Israel has to move its Iron Dome missile defense positions to try and protect itself. Sales of gas masks are up, and their vulnerability is once again exposed, and that security situation is once again dictating their position. Just to get back to one thing that you were talking about earlier about this reluctance to arm rebels and maybe provide non-lethal aid, I think, as Deb said, Salam Idris is not equipped to win at this point. And a lot of rebel commanders, if you talk to them now, will say, well, thanks for these radios and body armor, et cetera, but if it's not weapons, it's really not going to do much good.
Deb Amos, let me ask you about the Arab League. These are 22 states in the region. The Arab League has said that it doesn't support military action, I guess, without UN consent. At the same time, I do believe we know that Saudi Arabia has been funneling money to various Syrian rebels, and certainly openly not friendly towards the Assad regime. What are the calculations they're making?
I think we are seeing the same dynamics that we saw when the Arab League decided to kick Syria out of the organization. You saw a split vote. You also saw some Arab states, including Jordan, which is a U.S. ally, say that they wouldn't abide by the sanctions. They wouldn't stop flying into Syria, although they have now, simply because it is too dangerous for commercial airliners to fly into Damascus International Airport. The Iraqis also took the same position as the Jordanians. They continued to trade. So I think an Arab League split vote doesn't really help. Individual states have said behind the scenes, certainly the Saudis have said that they are for an American strike. But it's 22 nations, and they have different politics, and especially those that are neighboring Syria. Jordan has been very clear that there will be no use of any part of Jordan for U.S. strikes, but at the same time, they are home to a covert program of training rebels, of having an operation room in Amman, of allowing a pipeline to go through. So they are walking a very fine line. They do not want retaliation against them if they appear to be siding with a U.S. strike against Damascus.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's forthcoming speech on Syria. I'm Scott Simon, joined by NPR correspondents around the world. The administration remains poised to launch a U.S. military strike in Syria. Of course, yesterday, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, made a forceful case for intervention. The administration has also released a four-page, unclassified intelligence summary contending that the Syrian government used chemical weapons that killed more than 1,400 Syrian men, women, and children. President Obama said those attacks have threatened U.S. national security, but a number of analysts say that the case for intervention at the moment is missing a legal framework. We're going to hear a report now from NPR's Jackie Northam.
President Obama said any American military action in Syria under consideration would be a limited, narrow act. He said the decision to act is part of a U.S. obligation as a world leader to make sure that regimes are held to account if found targeting their own people with weapons prohibited by international norms.
If there's a sense that over time nobody's willing actually to enforce them, then people don't take them seriously.
But saying it's the right thing to do doesn't necessarily mean it's legal under international law, says Matthew Waxman, a senior State Department official in the George W. Bush administration, now a professor at Columbia Law School.
Well, no doubt the fact that chemical weapons were used here on a large scale and the fact that they are unquestionably outlawed under international law will feature heavily in the public justification for any strike against Syria. But I don't think there are strong precedent, at least not yet, for the notion that military intervention is a legally appropriate response to violations of those taboos.
Waxman says there are some gray areas in the law, and that the only clear and universally recognized justifications for using force are self-defense against an armed attack or UN Security Council approval. He says neither of those is a viable option, especially as Russia would veto any vote at the UN. Waxman says administration lawyers are undoubtedly trying to find other legal frameworks for intervention in Syria. He says they could try to use a 1999 precedent, when President Bill Clinton ordered a NATO air war in Kosovo on humanitarian grounds.
The U.S. did not actually come out and say that the intervention in Kosovo was legal. What they said was that it was justified, and they picked that word very carefully to say that it was justified rather than legal, because I think the lawyers inside the Clinton administration concluded that there wasn't a strong legal argument, but for policy reasons, for moral reasons, there was a strong imperative to go in anyway.
Michael Scharf, an international law expert with Case Western Reserve University, says the Clinton administration argued that the Kosovo intervention should not be used as precedent for future justifications.
They said, we are afraid of humanitarian intervention because it's a concept that can so easily be abused as a pretext for land grabs and political change in neighboring countries. And therefore, they said at the time, this is not a precedent. But what's interesting is even a situation that is claimed not to be a precedent can become one.
Scharf says the Obama administration may find some relief in other international agreements regarding chemical weapons. The 1925 Geneva Protocol, which Syria signed in 1968, and the 1992 Chemical Weapons Convention. Both ban the use of chemical weapons.
Syria can't claim that because it didn't ratify the recent treaty, it's allowed to use chemical weapons. It simply is not. And also the Geneva Conventions, which it is a party to, clearly say you can't use chemical weapons against the civilian population. So it is in breach of one of the most important prohibitions in international law.
It appears President Obama agrees. It's widely believed a U.S. military intervention in Syria is imminent. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
Let me turn now to Ron Elving and to Scott Horsley, who join us in the studio. This administration says, look, this is not the intelligence mistake that was committed, I think we can fairly say now, in the run-up to the Iraq war. These are weapons that we know have already been used. We're not conducting a hunt for them. And therefore, they believe that they begin with a better point when we talk about the legal framework. On the other hand, this is an administration that came to office saying, we believe that Congress should be consulted and should take a vote on these kinds of things. Where does the legal framework stand now?
The legal framework revolves around laws, but it also revolves around this concept of justification. Whether or not you meet the letter of the law, it is perhaps more important from a political standpoint or a geopolitical standpoint or an American political standpoint to meet the justification standard. And if we had an international coalition here, as we have sometimes had in the past, mm-hmm. if we were seeing here the United States government leading an international coalition, Congress would probably not need as much push as they're going to need if we are looking at a solo situation. And if the United States is going alone, then it needs a national security justification. So in a sense, there is a preventative aspect here, as there was in Iraq. The idea was there was going to be some kind of mass weapon cache of weapons of mass destruction that was going to be found, and in some sense or another, that would justify U.S. action going in. That was never found, and that's the lesson we've all learned since then. But in this case, there is also a preventative element, and that is Secretary of State Kerry and the President have both made reference to having to do something about what's going on in Syria, because if we don't, those kinds of chemical weapons will pop up somewhere else. They're going to be used somewhere else. And if we want to prevent that even from happening to U.S. assets or someplace in this country, we have to act now. We cannot wait until later on. That's what the administration is saying.
President Obama might be beginning his remarks soon, but let me turn to Scott Horsley. How big was the defeat in Parliament of David Cameron? And how does that figure into events now?
Well, I think it was very big, and also I think it was unexpected. I think right up until the end, the U.S. thought that David Cameron could deliver a parliamentary vote, but it's obviously a cautionary tale. And if you look back, you know, to the U.S. involvement in Libya, where they did have U.N. support, they mm-hmm. did have a coalition that they were working with, they did have support from the Arab League, and the administration did not seek congressional approval for that. So I think it is they're very hesitant to go after congressional support in this instance when the deck is much more stacked against them.
And Ron Elving, striking off of the experience in Libya, because for months, even years, that had been cited as an example of the wisdom that this administration has had. They would draw a contrast to the last in putting together an international coalition and being able to effect military action that actually affected a change on the ground. Did that change after Benghazi, when you had Libya now cited as an example of America becoming involved to an uncertain result and our ambassador even gets killed in the process?
It's certainly difficult to bring up Libya now without everyone suddenly thinking of Benghazi as, at the very least, an ugly postscript to what had happened in Libya and an ugly comment on what continues to go on in the situation in that country. It's very hard to bring up Libya now as a positive example without people having that in their mind.
In fact, I've heard people bring it up as an example of the law of unintended consequences.
Precisely. At the same time, the basic facts of what went right with Libya when we chose to intervene as part of an international coalition facilitating the actions of NATO, that basic lesson is not really changed by what happened in Benghazi, and the administration continues to believe that what happened in Benghazi was a separate act, something that really could not be helped.
President Obama is now making his way to the podium in the Rose Garden. He's accompanied by Vice President Biden.
In the worst chemical President weapons Obama. Attack of the 21st century. Yesterday, the United States presented a powerful case that the Syrian government was responsible for this attack on its own people. Our intelligence shows the Assad regime and its forces preparing to use chemical weapons, launching rockets in the highly populated suburbs of Damascus, and acknowledging that a chemical weapons attack took place. And all of this corroborates what the world can plainly see. Hospitals overflowing with victims, terrible images of the dead. All told, well over 1,000 people were murdered. Several hundred of them were children. Young girls and boys gassed to death by their own government. Now, this attack is an assault on human dignity. It also presents a serious danger to our national security. It risks making a mockery of the global prohibition on the use of chemical weapons. It endangers our friends and our partners along Syria's borders, including Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and Iraq. It could lead to escalating use of chemical weapons or their proliferation to terrorist groups who would do our people harm. In a world with many dangers, this menace must be confronted. Now, after careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. This would not be an open-ended intervention. We would not put boots on the ground. Instead, our action would be designed to be limited in duration and scope. But I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out. Our military has positioned assets in the region. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has informed me that we are prepared to strike whenever we choose. Moreover, the chairman has indicated to me that our capacity to execute this mission is not time sensitive. It will be effective tomorrow, or next week, or 1 month from now. And I'm prepared to give that order. But having made my decision as Commander-in-Chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Over the last several days, we've heard from members of Congress who want their voices to be heard. I absolutely agree. So this morning, I spoke with all four congressional leaders and they've agreed to schedule a debate and then a vote as soon as Congress come back into session. In the coming days, my administration stands ready to provide every member with the information they need to understand what happened in Syria and why it has such profound implications for America's national security. And all of us should be accountable as we move forward, and that can only be accomplished with a vote. I'm confident in the case our government has made without waiting for UN inspectors. I'm comfortable going forward without the approval of a United Nations Security Council that so far has been completely paralyzed and unwilling to hold Assad accountable. As a consequence, many people have advised against taking this decision to Congress. And undoubtedly, they were impacted by what we saw happen in the United Kingdom this week when the parliament of our closest ally failed to pass a resolution with a similar goal, even as the Prime Minister supported taking action. Yet while I believe I have the authority to carry out this military action without specific congressional authorization, I know that the country will be stronger if we take this course and our actions will be even more effective. We should have this debate because the issues are too big for business as usual. And this morning, John Boehner, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and Mitch McConnell agreed that this is the right thing to do for our democracy. A country faces few decisions as grave as using military force, even when that force is limited. I respect the views of those who call for caution, particularly as our country emerges from a time of war that I was elected in part to end. But if we really do want to turn away from taking appropriate action in the face of such an unspeakable outrage, then we must acknowledge the costs of doing nothing. Here's my question for every member of Congress and every member of the global community. What message will we send if a dictator can gas hundreds of children to death in plain sight and pay no price? What's the purpose of the international system that we've built if a prohibition on the use of chemical weapons that has been agreed to by the governments of 98% of the world's people and approved overwhelmingly by the Congress of the United States is not enforced? Make no mistake, this has implications beyond chemical warfare. If we won't enforce accountability in the face of this heinous act, what does it say about our resolve to stand up to others who flout fundamental international rules, to governments who would choose to build nuclear arms, to terrorists who would spread biological weapons, to armies who carry out genocide? We cannot raise our children in a world where we will not follow through on the things we say, the accords we sign, the values that define us. So just as I will take this case to Congress, I will also deliver this message to the world. While the UN investigation has some time to report on its findings, we will insist that an atrocity committed with chemical weapons is not simply investigated, it must be confronted. I don't expect every nation to agree with the decision we have made. Privately, we've heard many expressions of support from our friends, but I will ask those who care about the writ of the international community to stand publicly behind our action. And finally, let me say this to the American people. I know well that we are weary of war. We've ended one war in Iraq, we're ending another in Afghanistan. And the American people have the good sense to know we cannot resolve the underlying conflict in Syria with our military. In that part of the world, there are ancient sectarian differences, and the hopes of the Arab Spring have unleashed forces of change that are going to take many years to resolve. And that's why we're not contemplating putting our troops in the middle of someone else's war. Instead, we'll continue to support the Syrian people through our pressure on the Assad regime, our commitment to the opposition, our care for the displaced, and our pursuit of a political resolution that achieves a government that respects the dignity of its people. But we are the United States of America, and we cannot and must not turn a blind eye to what happened in Damascus. Out of the ashes of World War, we built an international order and enforced the rules that gave it meaning. And we did so because we believe that the rights of individuals to live in peace and dignity depends on the responsibilities of nations. We aren't perfect, but this nation, more than any other, has been willing to meet those responsibilities. So to all members of Congress, of both parties, I ask you to take this vote for our national security. I am looking forward to the debate. In doing so, I ask you, members of Congress, to consider that some things are more important than partisan differences or the politics of the moment. Ultimately, this is not about who occupies this office at any given time. It's about who we are as a country. I believe that the people's representatives must be invested in what America does abroad. And now's the time to show the world that America keeps our commitments. We do what we say. And we lead with the belief that right makes might, not the other way around. We all know there are no easy options, but I wasn't elected to avoid hard decisions, and neither were the members of the House and the Senate. I've told you what I believe, that our security and our values demand that we cannot turn away from the massacre of countless civilians with chemical weapons. And our democracy is stronger when the President and the people's representatives stand together. I'm ready to act in the face of this outrage. Today, I'm asking Congress to send a message to the world that we are ready to move forward together as one nation. Thanks very much.
Will you forgo a strike if Congress disapproves?
President Obama has just concluded his remarks in the Rose Garden of the White House. There were a couple questions shouted out. The president didn't take them. You're listening to special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria from NPR News. Let's turn now to the panel of NPR reporters and experts that we have. Ron Elving and Scott Horsley join me in the studio. Some people were expecting the first chords of war to be played. Instead, it's the first chords of a debate. How does the president's announcement that he's going to seek approval from Congress change the timetable?
This obviously is going to delay any strikes that might eventuate, and it could actually mean we don't strike. That one question that was shouted as the president finished was, will you go ahead with the strikes if Congress doesn't approve? The president didn't answer, but that is the question. He has asserted he believes that he has the authority to do so, but that he believes also that the United States is a constitutional democracy, oldest in the world, and should not take an action of this kind without some show of approval from the Congress. He didn't say it absolutely must have it. He didn't say he would be bound by it, but he said it should. And that is probably a point that Congress is going to have a hard time arguing with, because Congress has been insisting that it should also. So now the onus has been passed. The burden, in a sense, is being shared.
Yeah. Scott Horsley, your reaction.
Yeah, the president said, I didn't take this job to avoid tough decisions, and neither should the members of the Senate or the House. So they've been clamoring for the right to weigh in, and he has said, okay, you've got it. Now you will have to go on record and say whether you're for or against this action. And moreover, he says he wants other countries to go on record. He mentioned that he's been getting tacit nods of approval from some of our allies around the world. But the
tacit nod from approval is, we'll hold your coat, we can't say anything publicly, but privately I'll say to you, good on you.
Exactly. And now he's asking other countries to go beyond that and stand up and say, we support this publicly.
Hmm. Tom Bowman, are you still with us, who covers the Defense Department for NPR?
Yes.
Tom, anticipating a debate, does that give the Syrian regime more time to do what? Maybe hide some assets, protect them from bombing?
Yeah, it's possible you could hide some of the assets. But again, some of the targets listed include headquarters, command and control centers. You're not going to be able to move those. But presumably you could hide evidence. You could move rockets and missiles and so forth. You could do a few things in the interim. Of course, there are satellites and drones and surveillance aircraft all over Syria right now. They'll be keeping an eye on what's being moved and who's doing what. So again, many of these targets are fixed sites. It's not going to really make much of a difference. And as the president said, he said he could use military action tomorrow or next week or next month. So we'll just have to see. But again, I don't see it having a great impact on the selected targets.
Aaron David Miller is a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center and joins us now. Mr. Miller, can you hear us?
I can, yeah.
What was your impression of the president's speech?
I have to tell you, I found this to be remarkable and extraordinary. Five times in the last 30-some years, presidents have initiated military action without seeking formal authorization from Congress. Panama, Grenada, Iraq 1.0, Libya, and Kosovo. And I found it remarkable that having made the case for, not for war, but for a limited strike, the president has now surrendered the initiative to a legislative process that could now risk his own commitment. And it really, to me, is extraordinary, and I think what it reveals is just how reluctant this president is to enter. And he's been the avoider-in-chief for the last 2 years on Syria. He's wisely and willfully avoided militarizing the U.S. role there. Assad gave him no choice, with the largest single deployment of chemical weapons since Saddam gassed the Kurds in Halabja in 1988. And it shows just how deep his reluctance is and how worried I think he is, despite his overall confidence about the capacity of the U.S. military to carry this out. What is the next step and what happens the day after? And if, in effect, he's going to take action, it's going to be with the broadest possible constituency. He's now challenged the Congress, in effect, to either make good on his own red line and on America's credibility to enforce some sort of accountability, or to preside over this outrageous and horrid use of chemical weapons. So I think it's a mixed message. And given, last point, given John Kerry's incredibly forceful statement, in which he literally, you would have thought that the United States was on the verge of invading a country and that the fulcrum of Western civilization is now Syria, it's really quite remarkable that the air seems to have gone out of the balloon, at least for the time being.
Is it a good thing at the same time, Mr. Miller? I mean, to evince that sense of moral outrage, but say, on the other hand, I'm going to leave it to other people to follow through?
Well, it does. I mean, it clearly shows to me, and maybe David Cameron's challenge the other day, the absence of a lot of support, tremendous uncertainty. After all, we're emerging from the two longest wars in American history, where the standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave, that this president really, if he's going to take this action, which is highly uncertain, and once you break the glass ceiling for military action in Syria, mm-hmm. the pressure and expectations for additional action in response to Assad's use of chemicals or even conventional weapons will grow. This president is going to do what he doesn't want to do and is reluctant to do. Seems to me he wants the broadest possible cushion and sense of shared responsibility on the part of the public and their elected representatives. The problem, of course, is that it reflects an enormous amount of doubt and uncertainty. And I think, last point, In the last week, Barack Obama has in effect created a new red line. If you look at statements on the record, off the record, from administration officials, including the president, this is the most telegraphed military initiative probably in the history of human warfare. I mean, we are on record as basically saying we are going to do this. And now he has injected tremendous uncertainty in the prospects that it's actually going to happen.
Aaron David Miller is public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks for being with us, Mr.
Always
Miller.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to special coverage of President Obama's speech and its aftermath now on Syria from NPR News. We're going to go to someone in Syria now. Quick question for you. I hope there's a yes or no answer, Scott Horsley. Is this a vote the president could lose?
Certainly. I mean, but Barack Obama, for all his caution, is a gambler. He is occasionally willing to take a high-risk gamble. He did that when he pushed for a health care overhaul, and this is another high-wire act. He's putting his faith that he and Secretary Kerry can make a case that the American people and their representatives will go along with.
To Damascus now, we go to Nata Kunanen, who helps visiting journalists, including NPR reporters. Nata, thank you very much for being with us.
You are welcome.
Were you able to hear the president's speech or hear about it?
I did.
What was your reaction?
Actually, he didn't say anything new since the last week. He repeat himself, but what is new, I noticed that he's begging the friends of the countries and the Congress to support him.
And, well, that's something, may we say safely, that doesn't happen in Syria?
What do you mean?
The leader of the country doesn't ask for the support of the people or for a legislative branch to approve of his actions or not.
No, it's not so, but I believe that last week he was so sure that he's going to beat us. He was so sure that he made the last decision. And now it seems to be that he's trying to find a way out of his last week's speech. Mm-hmm. That maybe the Congress doesn't accept it, so he have the way out.
Mm. Nada, what are things like in Damascus this evening?
Normal, as it has been like the last 2.5 years.
So you haven't noticed many differences in the city, given the state of alert?
Not really.
May I ask, you worried about your safety?
Not more than I have been the last 2.5 years.
Mm. So this week hasn't, to your mind, been any riskier than any other of the past 2.5 years.
Have you heard about a sentence? It says the dog who is barking doesn't bite.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. What was that?
Have you heard about a sentence? It says the dog who bark a lot doesn't bite.
The dog who barks a lot doesn't bite. I see. So did
so
you think
they have been arguing now for 2 weeks about attacking us, yeah, but nothing happened yet, and maybe nothing will happen.
Okay, so you thought the president's speech was in some ways a lot of barking.
The last 2 weeks, yes.
Okay, Nada Kunin in Damascus. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
David Rifkin is a former President Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush official. He has written in the past about his belief that President Obama doesn't need approval to launch any strikes in the Libyan conflict. Mr. Rifkin, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
What was your impression of the president's remarks today?
Extremely unfortunate. Let me say at the outset, there's nothing wrong with seeking approval from Congress in the formal authorization to use military force, not because it's constitutionally required. It's not under the circumstances, but because it's a good governance exercise. You want to get American people view at the takeoff, so view at the landing. But what troubles me the most, in order to get that approval, the president should have been spending overtime the last 2 weeks preparing the country, preparing the American people for this contingency. He has done nothing to prepare the country or Congress, and he's governed in the last 5 years in the spirit of bitter partisanship. So we're on a real risk of experiencing the same horrible embarrassment as happened with the British Parliament. And quite frankly, I'm not sure he would be that unhappy, because in a way it would get him off the hook.
Yeah. So you believe that it's a perfectly good thing to go to Congress, but the president has to be prepared for the fact that he might lose this battle, in part, in your estimation, because he hasn't prepared the way adequately.
Yes, and I hate to sound cynical, but I mean, defense, I mean, one of your previous guests, I think David Miller, was, you know, commenting on the level of credibility that is suffering. I'm not sure this president is concerned about it. There's an enormous difference in the way he fights for domestic policy measures that are really, truly in his wheelhouse, like Obamacare. When it comes to fighting to protect, you know, the ability to launch drone strikes or continue to have robust NSA use force, as I said, I'm not sure he would be that unhappy. In fact, Congress would hand him an alibi, and there's a real chance for it. Republicans are not very much behind it. A number of Democrats are not very much behind it. And one last thing, there's so many reasons to use force against Assad, quite aside from the use of chemical weapons. He's been committing genocide against the Sunnis, which is a violation of a genocide convention. He is not going to transition, if he survives, from being a client of Iran to being a vassal of Iran. We've lost whatever credibility we have with all of the countries in the Middle East, both our friends and our enemies. It's not a monocausal situation, so pivoting or pegging everything to the use of chemical weapons is a strange way to justify the use of force, just like it was strange to justify the use of force against Saddam Hussein solely on the proposition that he had a stockpile of weapons of mass destruction.
David Rifkin is a former official in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Mr. Rifkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Let me turn now to NPR's Ron Elving. Where do you see the contours of some of the debate to come in Congress right now?
There are a great number of members of Congress who are already on the record saying primarily that the president ought to come to us for an authorization. They haven't said that much about whether or not they'd be for it, but they are definitely in favor of the president coming to them, I almost said the parent, coming to them for the authorization. I think a lot of those people might have just swallowed very hard in the last hour because I don't think they had much expectation that the president would do so. Now that he has said he is going to, rather, this is a rather different proposition for the members of Congress. Because
let me interject something. Were there some members of Congress who felt this was a way of being against military action without actually having to be against military action in terms of casting a vote?
Surely. Certainly there were also those who knew they were against military action and were not going to favor it and wanted the vote because they wanted to vote against it. And then there were those who favor military action and would like to have the vote because they want to stand and be counted. Mm-hmm. But then there is also a large number of members of Congress for whom the easiest criticism to register in all of this moral conundrum is to say the president must come to us, should come to us, we want the president to come to us for authorization, without necessarily saying whether or not they would give it. That's the easy place to be, and by and large, that's where a lot of people have been in the last several days.
It strikes me as we sit here now that you can't draw the divide between Republicans and Democrats. Both parties are split on this right now.
Yes, and always have been on the questions of military use of force. But at the same time, there has been something more of a chorus on the Republican side of people saying this: the president should not do this, the president can't do this, the president doesn't have the authority to do this, whereas Democrats, starting with the leadership, have felt more of an obligation to support the president. For example, Speaker Pelosi, who might not be thought of as the biggest hawk in the world, generally mm-hmm. speaking, has said that the president has the authority and should act, much as the president said today he thought he had the authority and should act, and she gave him her support. That has been typical of the Democrats, not typical of the Republicans.
Scott Horsley, I was struck watching you here as you sat in our studio because you're somebody who covers the White House. You cover it very well. You talk to people there all the time. Would it be fair to say you didn't see this coming?
No, I didn't see this coming. I don't think there's a lot in the president's past performance that would have predicted this. But I have to disagree with what David Rifkin said. I don't think in any way the president here is looking for an alibi from Congress. I don't think in any way he wants to be let off the hook by Congress with a no vote. I think he is very committed to going ahead with a military strike and has somewhat reluctantly decided that he will seek congressional buy-in on that. But I think there's a difference here. He was obviously very reluctant to intervene in the Syrian civil war. I think David Rifkin's right that he's somewhat ambivalent about the use of the drones and the NSA surveillance. But I think he feels very strongly about this need on the part of the United States and frankly, the international community to not let the use of chemical weapons stand. And I think he feels that very strongly.
His words were very forceful on that. I made a note. He said, "We are the United States of America, and we cannot turn a blind eye to what happened in Damascus."
And he's been saying that really ever since the evidence was presented about the strike on the 21st that killed so many people. So I think this is a gamble for him, and I think he's going to have to put a lot of effort, and the administration is going to have to put a lot of effort into winning that over the vote over from Congress. They do have some time. Lawmakers aren't due to come back into session until the 9th of September. So if they hadn't built their case before now, they have some time to do so.
Scott Horsley, who covers the White House, Ron Elving, NPR's Washington, who's in charge of NPR's Washington desk, and NPR correspondents around the world have joined us listening to President Obama. You've been listening to special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria, being brought to you by NPR News. This is NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria. I'm Scott Simon, joined now in our studio by Ron Elving and Scott Horsley, who covers the White House. Scott, in the debate that the president said is ahead, and the vote, you're already getting some reaction from Congress.
That's right. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says the president's role as commander-in-chief is always strengthened when he enjoys the express support of the Congress. He doesn't say that perhaps that the
He'll
president
vote.
needed to have that that endorsement or that it was that how he'll vote for it, but he just expresses support that he's bringing the issue to Congress. We've also heard from Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican, who is, I think you'd have to say, one of Mr. Obama's relative allies on the Republican mm-hmm. side. He's part of the supper club that's been meeting with the president on other issues, fiscal issues and so forth. Among Republicans in the Senate, he's been maybe more supportive of this president than some others. Corker says, I'm very pleased the president's listened to the suggestions we and others have made to bring the authorization to Congress. He also says it's imperative that Obama immediately begins using every ounce of his energy to make his case to the American people. So I think Corker is someone who is probably supportive of military action, but wants to see the president make that case.
Yeah. Ron Elving, the implication of what Senator Corker said, at least in recognizing, albeit he's had good relations with the president, he is of the other party, the implication seems to be that he believes the president hasn't spent enough time trying to convince Congress already.
That is a judgment that we're going to hear a lot, that the president would not be in this spot, and that possibly, for all we know, even Parliament would have voted differently. If Barack Obama, with his hortatory powers, with his persuasive powers, had been out there really pedal to the metal for the last couple of weeks since this attack took place.
We're joined now by Representative Barbara Lee, who's a Democrat from California. She sent a letter to President Obama that has been signed by 60 members of Congress, insisting that Congress should authorize any action, or, like the British Parliament, perhaps not authorize it. Representative Lee, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for giving me the chance to talk with you for a few minutes.
Do you want to make this a short conversation and tell us how you're going to vote?
No, I think what is important right now is that the president did the right thing, even though he did say up front that he's going to conduct military strikes. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, and I'm sure he's very clear and adamant on that. But the point that many of us have been raising, I think now probably 64 members have signed our initial letter. The point is that this is a democracy, and in a democracy, you know, the voices and the will of people need to be heard through their congressional representatives. There are many, many issues that have to be discussed that people need to listen to and debate. One is what are any unintended consequences that could occur? We don't know that. What are the ramifications for retaliation or regional conflict? We don't know that. I am one who really believes that, like I think everyone, that the use of chemical weapons is, unacceptable and should never, never, never occur. It's deplorable, and they're crimes against humanity, and so we have to address that. The question is, I think, and this is what needs to be debated, will military intervention and is there a military solution? And in fact, if we believe that the only way to get to the stopping this carnage and this violence and this civil war is through a negotiated settlement, what do military strikes achieve toward that end? And that's the question I think we have to debate. Secretary Kerry said very clearly there's no military solution and we've got to seek a negotiated settlement. And so in the debate, you know, and I'm very pleased, again, that the president's calling for this debate, even though we know he's going to take action, is we need to know what the outcome could be and what the possible unintended consequences are.
Mm. Representative Lee, realistically, and I address this question to you as a politician, can you ever really know what the consequences of an action are? I mean, can you really get that signed, sealed, and delivered from a politician?
No, you can't, but you can anticipate a variety of scenarios. You can talk about alternatives. You can talk about possibilities. You can never, in politics or in anything, come up with any certainty on any outcome. But you certainly can look at possible impacts, civilian, more death possible, more chemical attacks. Is that possible? What does this scenario mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think we can at least anticipate and talk about alternatives without coming to any conclusion with regard to exactly what could happen.
Representative Lee, you've been home in your district. How deeply do people in your district care about Syria and care about Syria policy?
Well, I think, like throughout the country, people in my district first care about these crimes against humanity and don't want to see innocent civilians, men, women, and children being killed and chemical attacks occurring. So I think that's the first concern and the first outcry and outrage that I've heard. People, secondly, are war-weary in my district like throughout the rest of the country, mm-hmm. and are very careful in terms of any kind of support for military actions without understanding what the consequences are, what the time frame is, what actually could be the result of that. Now, a three-day strike, a one-day strike, people may say, okay, fine. How certain are we that what is that going to be? So I think people in my district, like throughout the country, are very cautious, but they're outraged at what has taken place in Syria. And, in fact, understand that in the last couple of years, over 100,000 people have been killed. And so that there's a civil war taking place. The region is in chaos. And so people here in California, in Northern California, and I think throughout the country, really understand what's at play and know that we have to be very, very deliberate in how we approach this. And hopefully we'll do whatever it takes to get to a negotiated settlement.
Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Of course, you're listening to special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria from NPR News. The president finished his speech just a few moments ago in the Rose Garden, and he laid out his argument for a military strike against Syria in definite terms.
In a world with many dangers, this menace must be confronted. After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. This would not be an open-ended intervention. We would not put boots on the ground. Instead, our action would be designed to be limited in duration and scope. But I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out.
President Obama did not say when a strike might happen, but he emphasized that the United States was ready.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has informed me that we are prepared to strike whenever we choose. Moreover, the chairman has indicated to me that our capacity to execute this mission is not time sensitive. It will be effective tomorrow or next week or 1 month from now. And I'm prepared to give that order.
And then the president made another major and unexpected announcement.
I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Over the last several days, we've heard from members of Congress who want their voices to be heard. I absolutely agree. So this morning, I spoke with all four congressional leaders, and they've agreed to schedule a debate and then a vote as soon as Congress come back into session.
While President Obama made it clear that he wants to include the U.S. Congress, he did not seem to show the same deference towards the United Nations.
I'm confident in the case our government has made without waiting for UN inspectors. I'm comfortable going forward without the approval of a United Nations Security Council that so far has been completely paralyzed and unwilling to hold Assad accountable.
President Obama said this was about more than what's happening in Syria and framed it as a matter of principle and standing up for international law.
Make no mistake, this has implications beyond chemical warfare. If we won't enforce accountability in the face of this heinous act, what does it say about our resolve to stand up to others who flout fundamental international rules, to governments who would choose to build nuclear arms, to terrorists who would spread biological weapons, to armies who carry out genocide? We cannot raise our children in a world where we will not follow through on the things we say.
We're going to turn now for some reaction to President Obama's remarks to Colonel Morris Davis, a former U.S. Air Force colonel who's now a professor of law at Howard University and considered to be an expert on international law. Colonel, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Do you think the president presented a legal framework for what he wants to do?
I heard no justification for us taking unilateral action. There's no basis under international law for a country to unilaterally decide that we're going to intervene in Syria from what the president said today.
What is the president missing? A vote from the UN Security Council, which he clearly knows is just not going to materialize. Authorization from Congress, would that make it legal?
Well, the congressional part, and I do give him credit for going to Congress and seeking their approval. That answers the domestic legal question. You still have the international legal question of when does a country have the right to attack another country? And absent some imminent right of self-defense, which I haven't heard anything articulated, that there's an imminent threat to the United States, you know, you don't have the right just to go attack another country because they've done something you disagree with. I mean, he said we want to enforce the principles. You can't ignore conventions and international standards. Yet he's taken the look forward, don't look back approach when we violated the Convention Against Torture. So we're very selective, and we like international law when it supports what we want to do, but we tend to just ignore it when it doesn't. So the UN, he's largely said the UN is irrelevant. If we were honest, we'd just quit the UN because we just ignore what the UN has to say when it is contrary to what we want to do.
Well, but we're deeply invested in a lot of its humanitarian programs, as often pointed out. I wonder, what do you think about the argument the president made that a regime that demonstrates that it will use chemical weapons is a regime that could wind up making those weapons available to people who would use them against the United States and in fact, might in the future?
Well, it's a slippery slope argument that's been used many times in the past. There's certainly been, there's no, at least not that I've been privy to, any information that chemical weapons have been provided to any terrorist organizations or anyone else that pose an imminent threat to the U.S. So, it's to me, basically a fear-mongering tactic on what potentially might happen at some point in the future. But again, that's not a legal justification under any principle of international law that I'm aware of that authorizes the U.S. to attack Syria.
Well, and to revisit this question one last time, if we could, Colonel Davis, what about the president's argument that in using chemical weapons, the regime in Damascus has violated international agreements, violated international norms, and can't hide behind sovereignty?
Well, again, I think we'd be in a stronger position, morally and legally, if he held us to the same standard. Because, clearly since 9/11, we violated a number of, international norms and conventions. And the president is taking a look forward, don't look back approach and given impunity for war crimes that we've committed. Yet, we're about to launch a military attack on another country for doing the same thing. So it's hypocritical to say the law applies to Assad and it doesn't apply to the United States.
Retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Morris Davis, now professor of law at Howard University. Colonel, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We want to go to NPR's Deborah Amos, who has spent a good long time covering the Middle East, to get some of her reaction. Deborah, are you with us?
I am indeed, Scott, and I've been watching social media. There's been some very interesting tweets as we all sort of grapple with this stunning announcement by the president. The most interesting is that Syrian State TV broadcast the president's speech live with translations. That is the first time that has ever happened. So on the one hand, Syrians watched a president who they were sure were going to bomb them say that he was going to Congress. But on the other hand, they saw a president charge their own president with killing civilians, with chemical weapons. And that is certainly a first in Syria.
That the Syrian public actually heard these charges.
Indeed. Indeed.
Do you think this is a decision that that might impress people on the Arab street, to use that term?
I think it will be confusing for them. The president, on the one hand, said that he himself had made the decision. As we know, yesterday in his speech, he kept saying he hadn't made the decision, even after the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's impassioned speech. Today, he said he had made that decision, but he was going to go to Congress. I think that will be confusing for Syrians on either side of the divide who expect America to be decisive. And in places that don't have functioning Congresses, it is very unusual for a leader of a country to turn over that kind of important decision. So, yes, I think that there is some anger. You can see it on social media already.
Ron Elving, who runs NPR's Washington desk, is nodding his head in agreement. Ron?
Congress is confusing. It's confusing to those of us who are accustomed to it. The idea of people suddenly being acquainted with it by this decision by the president is indeed confusing, and I can imagine how it would be truly confounding for people around the world to think that suddenly we were going to make this kind of decision. But there actually is a precedent for it. For example, President H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. The first President Bush back in 1991, before unleashing the forces that had been built up over a number of months to respond to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in the summer of 1990, before he unleashed that invasion of Kuwait and Iraq, of course, partially, we didn't go all the way to Baghdad that time. Before he did that, he went to Congress for approval, and they had a robust debate in the House and in the Senate. It was extensive. It was rational. It was impressive. I think it was an example to all the world in democratic decision-making, and eventually a vote. It was not a slam-dunk vote in either chamber, to borrow a phrase, and that vote then approved the president going forward, and he did so. What he would have done with these forces that had already been gathered if the Congress had voted the other way, we'll never know, but the Congress supported him. He went forward. This vote, I suspect, will be somewhat different. The dynamics of it are different. Of course, we had a partisan president and Congress split then, too. We had a president who was a Republican in Congress that was Democratic, both House and Senate. Now we have a divided Congress and a Democratic president. It will be interesting to see how the two chambers differ.
Mm-hmm. Scott Horsley, you wanted to add something?
Well, as you've pointed out, though, Scott, in the fault lines in this decision aren't necessarily partisan fault lines. We have Republicans who are for and against military action, and those who are against, some of them want no action, and some of them want more action. And we certainly have Democrats who are split as well. It'll be interesting to see how the Democrats fall on this issue, since the justification here is not to tip the balance in the Civil War, but to stand up for an international norm against the use of chemical weapons. We did get a statement now from the leadership in the House, the GOP leadership in the House, saying they're glad that the president has decided to seek authorization for military action under the Constitution. The Republican House leaders say the responsibility to declare war lies with Congress. And they say they look forward to a debate in response to, quote, serious substantive questions being raised. So not really tipping their hands one way or another about how they might vote once that vote is held.
This it occurs to me as we sit here, this is not a vote that's going to be that's easy to predict as of this day at all. Unlike, I think we can fairly say, a lot of votes that are taken in Congress.
That's right. And the House leaders also say that they expect that consideration to begin on September 9th. That is when the House was already scheduled to come back into session.
So they're not going to be called back. Not pull a David Cameron, if you please. Call people back from their vacation.
Some lawmakers have already suggested that they should come back early, but the indication from House leaders is that they probably will stick with the existing schedule, and that buys a week for President Obama to make his case.
Scott Horsley, Ron Elving, Deborah Amos, you're listening to special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria from NPR News. This is NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of President Obama's speech on Syria and its aftermath. I'm Scott Simon. We want to go now to NPR's Tom Bowman, who covers the Defense Department. Tom, you with us?
Yes, I am, Scott.
This debate that's going to open up in Congress, a lot of people are going to ask, what does the military think? Let's get there first. What does the military think?
Well, General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has written a couple of letters to Congress. And in it, he talks about his reluctance to move on military action here. He says that regardless of what you do, from limited strikes to a no-fly zone to a buffer zone, that may not achieve what you want, removing Assad from power. The sense is, too, that he favors building a more moderate opposition in Syria. He wrote that in a letter a week and a half ago to Congressman Elliot Engel, a Democrat of New York. He said we could do that if asked to do so, which is interesting, and a lot of people have seized on that. Why haven't you been asked to do so? So he's going to be pulled up to the Hill in the midst of this debate, saying, General, what do you think? And he's basically going to say, listen, you know, military action could make things worse there, that the military action is not a solution to some of these serious problems within Syria. And then you talk to other analysts, military officials privately, and they'll say, mounting these limited attacks really won't accomplish much. And what's the strategy? A lot of them are scratching their head saying there really is no strategy.
Mm. If asked to do so, would that entail providing, I'm asking you to fill in the blanks, but providing weapons to certain members, to certain opposition groups and withholding them from others, funding, that sort of thing?
Well, it's uncertain what we're talking about. Someone I was talking with, a Pentagon official, said maybe we'll provide more training, more coordination. There is a certain number of arms already going to the rebels from the Saudis and others. Mm-hmm. Now, the CIA, we believe, is providing some sort of arms, but there's been a reluctance to provide, let's say, shoulder-fired missiles because you're afraid they'll fall into the wrong hands. There's going to be a debate clearly about that in the coming weeks as Congress weighs military action against Syria. What more can be done here? Mm.
Scott Horsley, there could be a split between General Dempsey, a very public split between General Dempsey and the Commander-in-Chief.
Well, right, although I think General
Dempsey... He's always good about saying, I follow the Commander-in-Chief
We salute and follow orders, absolutely. Yeah. I think his concern, though, is really about... getting more deeply involved into the civil war and something that could result in Assad being replaced with opposition figures that we're not really comfortable with, as opposed to, again, the very limited action that the president's contemplating here.
Let's go now to Peter Kenyon, who's been watching the situation from Beirut. Peter, are you with us?
I am, Scott.
Peter, I think we have reviewed in the past the fact that you have at least some regimes in the Middle East. Let me coin a phrase, who want to lead from behind, who want the United States to act, but don't necessarily want their thumbprints on it, at least publicly. I wonder, I'm thinking now of, for example, Saudi Arabia. Are the Saudis likely to hear President Obama's speech and think that's the kind of leadership we want?
Well, I think perhaps not. But on the other hand, they may also be feeling a little pressure to perhaps come out of their shell and be a little more open about what we're told is their private endorsement of a strike against Syria. And that sort of raises the question of what could happen in this delay that we've got, a delay because so many people were assuming that something was happening imminently. Yeah. Now we have at least several days. What is going to change in that time? Is Syria going to continue, for instance, to deny that it even used chemical weapons as this evidence comes out? Will Russia continue to say it's unthinkable, it's nonsense, it couldn't possibly have happened? I mean, I think there are certain possibilities for the political situation, if you will, to change in that period of time. And one other thing while I'm on here, we're mm-hmm. just getting some reaction from the Syrian opposition and from the rebels. Abu Othman, who was the leader of a rebel brigade in Damascus suburbs, we reached him via Skype, and he said he's trying to put a good face on it. He says they're still hopeful that the strike will take place. It's just a matter of time. But he also emphasized that any delay is greatly increasing pressure on the rebels. As Debemis mentioned, mm-hmm. the upper hand has been with the Syrian army lately, and there could be a move now to try and consolidate that advantage.
So when you say the political situation could change between now and the opening of the debate on September 9th, which is open-ended at this particular point, you think this could come at this probably will come at the expense of rebel groups?
That certainly is going to be the impression that they have. They have been trying for years now to convince Syrians that they have the backing of the international community, that there is clout and weight and resources behind them. and they keep getting disappointed time and time again. But in a broader sense, what I meant by the idea of the political situation changing, I was being perhaps a little optimistic, but there is now more time for all of these things that haven't happened yet, perhaps even the British Parliament having another vote at some point. And if not that, perhaps other countries coming forward. So there is time for the general heft of opinion to change.
Scott Horsley, the G20 meeting is coming out. The president gets
one of the countries that Peter mentioned is Russia. When the president talks about how the United Nations has been completely paralyzed in the face of this chemical weapons attack, the country that's been behind the paralysis, of course, is Russia. Mm-hmm. And next week, President Obama is going to be in Russia for the meeting of the G20. He initially was supposed to go to Moscow for a one-on-one meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. That was canceled, but they're still going to be the president sitting at a big table with a lot of other world leaders, including President Putin. And it'll be interesting to see what that atmosphere is like. There was a lot of concern about what the atmosphere would be like had the U.S. gone ahead and launched a military strike in the days leading up to that meeting. Now, instead, we'll have, it looks like, sort of a pregnant pause while we wait to see.
And I guess President Putin could say, oh, putting it to a vote of a legislature, I never thought of that. let's turn to Deb Amos. You're still with us, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Deborah, let me ask you about about other nations that are in the Arab League. How are they likely to react?
Well, as I said earlier, I think this idea that Congress has control of foreign policy is going to be a bit confusing in the region. We still have an Arab League meeting to go. It is possible that we will see a different outcome in that meeting. I think they thought that they could get off scot-free. It was easy to sort of sit back and, as you earlier said, after you, Alphonse, I'll hold your coat and you go do it. Those members of the Arab League who want the U.S. to take more action are going to have to be more forceful in their argument. They may have their own vote. So let's see what happens in the region. I think people are now just taking this in. This is a remarkable turn of events. I think no one could have predicted it looking at the rhetoric coming out of Washington yesterday. So it's going to be a while till we get reactions from Riyadh, from Amman. I haven't seen anything so far officially from any Arab government on what they make of this decision by the president to consult with Congress. And delay any decisions.
Let me ask all of you to stand by. Representative Jim McDermott of Washington State joins us now. Representative McDermott, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You were one of the members of Congress who signed a letter asking for this debate. Is this exactly what you wanted?
Absolutely. I'm pleased the president did not oppose that and try to do it alone. I think this is the way it should be done in a democracy.
Are you leaning one way or another as we speak now?
Well, I lean against, but I'm frankly a physician, and I like to know what the evidence is. I like to know what are we looking at really here, because I'm worried about Russia. I'm worried about Iran. There has been no talk whatsoever about any diplomatic efforts to get the Russians to deal with their clients, who are clearly the Syrians. I mean, the Syrians are receiving from the Russians, and we can blow up sarin gas tomorrow afternoon, but more will appear in Syria if we don't get into the diplomatic discussions that have to be a part of this. So I'm simply making a strike from the air is not, to me, that's doesn't give the kind of message that we want, because it has no long-term effect.
Mm. The president, the leader of your party, made a very forceful argument, as Secretary Kerry did on Friday, that what happened in Damascus amounted to a crime against humanity, and that as the President Obama said, we are the United States of America, and we have to evince strong disapproval of what happened in Damascus. How do you feel about that? How would such disapproval be expressed?
Well, it's very hard to do because they never signed that. They did not break anything they ever signed. So they've broken a treaty that we signed, and we say that they have to follow our treaty. You might ask the same question about the International Criminal Court. We don't join that. So we are not judged by the same standard as other people. So you got to be careful about what moral authority you want to use. It clearly is horrendous what they did to their people, if that's what occurred. And my view is that we should use every method we can short of war before we unleash the war. Because I don't think we know what the outcome of that will be. If we send in 50 Tomahawk missiles, we may or may not set off some things in other parts of the Middle East that we are just not contemplating. I think we have to have time to think about it. What is most difficult with this 24/7 news cycle, mm-hmm. is that there's very little time for people to think. And we're being given the bum's rush here. They're telling us, come back tomorrow, and we'll give you a briefing in Washington, D.C., a secret briefing in Washington, D.C. Well, I mean, I'm on the West Coast. What am I supposed to do, run down and come in on a red eye so I can come to a briefing? I mean,
well, Congressman, it's with respect, it's a pretty important issue, isn't it? I mean,
very much so. But the president said, if you go back and listen to what he said, the Joint Chiefs of Staff told him it is not time sensitive. It doesn't have to be done within the next 12 hours or the next 24 or the next 48. And once you said that, means you've got some time to think about it.
Well, we've also just heard our correspondents express the idea that also gives time for the Syrian regime and the military to crack down even more.
That is possible, and that would make it even more likely that we would strike. I mean, I think if they turned loose more gas now, they would just be asking for it. So if that's what they're implying by that kind of an analysis, I think that it's time for us to sit and carefully think about what we did. We did not think when we got into Afghanistan what we were really getting into. And we got ourselves into a mess, and we never got Osama bin Laden for 10 years. And what we did was we created a real mess that we're still stuck in. So I don't want us to have that same kind of thing happen here in Syria, Iraq, Iran, in the Fertile Crescent, really. You could wind up with real problems. And that's, I'm cautious in that sense. I'm conservative in that sense. I don't want to jump quickly until I've looked carefully and thought about all the possibilities.
Representative Jim McDermott of Washington State, thanks very much for being with us, sir.
You're welcome.
Let me turn to Ron Elving and Scott Horsley. September 9th, Congress will be back. The debate begins. As has been suggested, we've seen maybe a couple of things in our recent past that come close. Ron Elving, how do you see the president framing the argument for Congress?
The Congress will begin formally talking about this in the week of September 9th when they formally return. But as the congressman has suggested, with the 24/7 news cycle, I expect we're going to be hearing a great deal about this over the next 7, 8, 9 days, and that Congress is going to be conducting the debate, in essence, over the airwaves, that we're all going to be talking about it, that the members are going to be talking about it, that every expert that ever walked is going to be consulted on this, and everyone's going to have a view. So that we're already going to hear a lot of people.
I mean, they're already coming in on Twitter now.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And between the social media and all the things that we can all see at once, this is going to be perhaps the most mediated, conducted in the media debate that we have ever had about a war or an offensive action or a military action in U.S. history. And much of that debate is going to take place immediately. It's not going to wait until September 9th. I suspect we'll know where a lot of members are before they actually get back and begin a formal debate.
Because they're at home, of course, too.
Congressman McDermott mentioned the classified briefing that's going to go on for Republicans and Democrats in the House tomorrow. The White House says that's not the last opportunity, but it's one of a series of briefings that is being provided to members of Congress.
Ron Elving and Scott Horsley, thanks so much. And as we wind down our special coverage of Syria, here is how President Obama concluded his 10-minute address from the Rose Garden earlier this afternoon.
I know well that we are weary of war. We've ended one war in Iraq. We're ending another in Afghanistan. And the American people have the good sense to know we cannot resolve the underlying conflict in Syria with our military. In that part of the world, there are ancient sectarian differences. in the hopes of the Arab Spring have unleashed forces of change that are going to take many years to resolve. And that's why we're not contemplating putting our troops in the middle of someone else's war. Instead, we'll continue to support the Syrian people through our pressure on the Assad regime, our commitment to the opposition, our care for the displaced, and our pursuit of a political resolution that achieves a government that respects the dignity of its people. But we are the United States of America. And we cannot and must not turn a blind eye to what happened in Damascus. Out of the ashes of World War, we built an international order and enforced the rules that gave it meaning. And we did so because we believe that the rights of individuals to live in peace and dignity depends on the responsibilities of nations. We aren't perfect, but this nation, more than any other, has been willing to meet those responsibilities. So to all members of Congress of both parties, I ask you to take this vote for our national security. I am looking forward to the debate. In doing so, I ask you, members of Congress, to consider that some things are more important than partisan differences or the politics of the moment. Ultimately, this is not about who occupies this office at any given time. It's about who we are as a country. I believe that the people's representatives must be invested in what America does abroad. And now's the time to show the world that America keeps our commitments. We do what we say. And we lead with the belief that right makes might, not the other way around. We all know there are no easy options, but I wasn't elected to avoid hard decisions, and neither were the members of the House and the Senate. I've told you what I believe, that our security and our values demand that we cannot turn away from the massacre of countless civilians with chemical weapons. And our democracy is stronger when the President and the people's representatives stand together. I'm ready to act in the face of this outrage. Today I'm asking Congress to send a message to the world that we are ready to move forward together as one nation.
President Obama addressing the nation from the White House Rose Garden earlier today, in which he announced that he had concluded that the United States should launch some kind of an attack against Syria, although he did not say when. The president did say that he will now seek congressional approval before taking any military action against Syria. This has been special coverage of President Obama's speech. From NPR News, I'm Scott Simon.